Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. That was the most lackluster good afternoon back I've ever heard in my life. Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon.
Oh, that sounds better. Sorry about that. My wife, Diane, she's the pretty one with the book. Well, there's a lot of pretty women in here. Sorry. She's the prettiest woman sitting there back there in the back. We're here in Arkansas spending a couple days, actually till Tuesday, just on like a little getaway. And so we're actually staying in Hot Springs, which we've never been to this area of the country before, and very interesting area. So we went and walked around downtown Hot Springs yesterday and saw the bath houses and took a couple tours. We didn't take baths. That just seems kind of weird to me. You know, I mean, we took baths before we came here, obviously. That's not what I'm saying, but it's just kind of a little strange to think about public baths. So I emailed Mr. Nance, said, hey, I was going to be in the area and just wanted to know where we could go to church. But then he said, well, would you like to speak? And I said, well, I wasn't planning on it, but that's fine. I knew Mr. Nance from back in Michigan. We actually were kind of in the same area for a while. I just knew him just a little bit before he took off for the to start his pastor responsibilities. And love him. He's a nice guy. We've since got to know each other a little bit better through general conferences of elder meetings, that type of stuff. So I welcome, I thank him for letting us speak here today. Thank you for letting me speak here today. And hopefully we'll be friends by the time this sermon is done. We'll find out. Go ahead and hit that first slide if you can. This is what we do in Paducah. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. We know that the world is going to, so we know Tuesday that the world is going to be observing Christmas. And when I say the world, I mean practically the whole world, as we'll see in a little bit. But thanks to God's calling, we all realize that many of the traditions that are associated with the Christmas season have their roots in pagan customs, pagan traditions, pagan practices that happened in most cases long before Jesus Christ was born. And the sermon's not about that. It's not about those things, because that's not really in dispute, is it? I mean, nobody would argue with you that Christmas does not have those types of roots. You can read it in any encyclopedia. You can look it up on the internet, do a Google search about Christmas and his origins, and you'll read the same thing. These traditions, for the most part, and these practices, they come from these ancient practices that have little or nothing to do with God or the Bible. And it is what it is, right? It is what it is. That's reality. That's the way it is. But as Christians, we have a aspect of reality that we have to deal with, that we have to take into account. We realize that as members of God's church, that Jesus Christ commanded us to observe different days. He commanded us to observe his holy days. And those holy days are laid out for us in Scripture, and we know that they're listed in Leviticus 23. So we do what the Bible says to do. We do these things, and we do them gladly and with joy. And this sermon is not about that. That's a given for us, too. But none of this changes the fact that there is a Christmas. None of that changes the fact that Christmas is something that's there. And that's because it's so much in our face, especially this time of the year, right? I mean, you practically can't escape it. And that's because here in America and elsewhere around the world, Christmas is a really, really big deal. It really is. The shopping, the presents, the decorating, the customs, all that goes with them. People in the world and the United States, they all participate in at least some aspect of all those things. But why do people celebrate Christmas? If you were to ask someone, hey, why exactly do you celebrate Christmas? Most probably couldn't tell you. Some might have it figured out. They might say, well, we've always just done it that way. That's always just the way it's been. Somebody will say, well, I guess, you know, my mom did it, my dad did it, their mom and dad did it, their mom and dad before that did it. And so it's a tradition. Well, we know that traditions in general, they can be bad or they can be good, and they're part of every culture and every society. But then the real question is, when we look at Christmas in America, especially in America, how come all these Christmas traditions, all these practices are so uniform? I could leave here and drive up to Oregon. I heard one gentleman talking about that. And they're going to be observing Christmas the exact same way. I can go to New York City, and probably people are going to be celebrating Christmas the exact same way as they do here. Every kid knows the story about Santa Claus and the reindeers and the elves and the toy shop at the North Pole. Santa Claus comes down the chimney and leaves presents. How do they know these things? How do they know this? I didn't grow up in the church. I wasn't in the church for a long, long time until I became an adult. And so I celebrated a lot of Christmases. But I never had one time when I was a kid that Dad sat down with me and said, Doug, we're going to have the Christmas talk today. This is how it works. Santa is up at the North Pole. And he's building presents all year long. Oh, he's got a bunch of elves, right? And they all have these toy-making abilities. And then on Christmas Eve, they load everything up into this sleigh, and these reindeer go flying off with this sleigh. He comes to all the houses in one night, goes down the chimney, leaves cookies for him. I never got that talk. That doesn't exist. You never see that anywhere. So how does everybody learn these things? Where do all these ideas come from? That next slide. Well, the simple answer is from the mass media. From the mass media. Every year, millions of kids sit down and watch these types of shows at Christmas time. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. We got the Grinch. We got a Charlie Brown Christmas. We got Miracle on 34th Street. Just a few of them. You think about TV. Just about every regular TV series has a Christmas special, right? Special Christmas episode, right? That kind of thing. Movies. There's entire movies that are based around the concept that Christmas is something to observe and something to be celebrated. And these types of things are really, again, in the faces of kids all year long. I mean, if you have a TV, if you read, if you listen to the radio, anything, these things are going to be drilled into your mind as a kid, despite what your parents say or don't say in most cases, right? So kids can't escape these messages any more than we can. And when you think about kids, we know that they're a lot more trusting than we are, especially at the younger they are. So they just suck it all in like vacuum cleaners. And parents do little or nothing to dissuade them in most instances. So these things, they contribute to this continuation of the traditions and celebrations of our modern Christmas. They provide a framework and a template of how Christmas is supposed to be observed. They provide a common frame of reference for everyone who observes Christmas. They keep those myths going about Santa Claus. They show how to do certain traditions, how they're supposed to be done, like Christmas trees and family get-togethers, that type of stuff. Bottom line is, the mass media is very, very influential and very, very thorough in telling us every aspect of Christmas and how we're supposed to observe it. How did we get here? How did we get here? Most people don't really realize that at one point in America, Christmas was not a very big deal. It was not a very big deal. In fact, it didn't become a big deal until maybe 150 to 200 years ago. And it wasn't a big deal at that time, or before that time, due primarily to the influence of religion. Go ahead and hit that next one. Now, we know that if we've studied and we've done our reading that there were actually religious groups that did not celebrate Christmas. Puritans were one such group of people that would not celebrate Christmas. The screen up here, it shows a notice from a presumably a town up in the Northeast where they had banned the celebration of Christmas. And that notice says, "The observation of Christmas has been deemed a sacrilege. The exchanging of gifts and greetings, dressing in fine clothing, feasting, and similar satanical practices are hereby forbidden, with the offender liable to a fine of 5 shillings. So the Puritans and others, they recognized that Christmas was not biblical and was in fact an invention of man. And these groups, much more so than today, religion has not a lot of bearing on most people's lives, at least in the United States today, it seems like it. But back then, religion was a powerful, powerful force. So as a consequence, not many people celebrated it as a religious holiday. It just wasn't that big of a deal. And again, it was illegal in many parts of America. So what happened? What happened? How did we get from that point to where we are today? Well, there was a time in the 1800s where the mass media of the time did have a tremendous influence with the establishment of Christmas here in America. Because before there was TV, before there were radio, before there were movies, there was only one type of mass media, and that was the written word. The written word. Magazines, newspapers, books, this was the mass media of the time. And during the 1800s, the mass media of the time, in essence, created a new Christmas. A new Christmas. And this is a blending together of religion and ancient beliefs that created what is essentially a new mythology, a new popular idea of what Christmas is. And it's not really a religious observance today, and it's not really a secular observance today, but it's a blending together of ancient traditions with an optional religious component. You could say it's a Christmas for everyone, so to speak. Doesn't matter what your religious beliefs are. You can celebrate Christmas. So what I want to do in this sermon is to go over some of the literature of the 1800s that truly changed Christmas to what we know today, and then look at one work in particular that had a major, major influence on how the world celebrates Christmas today. I'm going to do that next slide. We're going to start, though, with this with an early American author by the name of Washington Irving. He lived from 1783 to 1859. Anybody know what character or book he was probably most well known for? Shout it out if you know. Rip Van Winkle. Rip Van Winkle. You've all heard about Rip Van Winkle, I assume. And he was the one that made that famous. But many don't also know that he was also responsible for helping to create many of the myths of our modern Christmas. Irving lived in New York in what was then populated largely by Dutch immigrants. And St. Nicholas was a popular figure in Dutch mythology and Dutch culture. And many of the aspects of Christmas that we have today, such as gifts and stockings, they came from there. In the Netherlands, Sinterklaas, or St. Nicholas, he would arrive on a horse or on a horse drawn with a wagon on Christmas. But it's interesting that the notion of flying through the air in a type of vehicle, in this case a sleigh or a wagon, that came from the mind of Washington Irving. That came from the mind of Washington Irving. In this book, which was called A History of New York, and it was written in or published in 1809, and it's not really a history, but it's really a parody of history of New York. In this book, a character has a dream, and I want to read a section of that dream that he had from this book to give us an understanding of how one thing written by a popular author can have so much influence. Go and hit that next one. Let's read from this book. And the sage Olaf dreamed a dream. And lo, the good Saint Nicholas came riding over the tops of the trees. What? In that self-same wagon wherein he brings his yearly presents to children. And he descended hard by where the heroes of Communpaw had made their late repast. And he lit his pipe by the fire and sat himself down and smoked. And as he smoked, the smoke from his pipe ascended into the air and spread like a cloud overhead. And Olaf bethought him, and he hastened and climbed up to the top of one of the tallest trees and saw that the smoke spread over a great extent of the country. Go ahead. And as he considered it more attentively, he fancied that the great volume of smoke assumed a variety of marvelous forms, where in dim obscurity he saw shadowed out palaces and domes and lofty spires, all of which lasted but a moment and then faded away until the whole rolled off and nothing but the green woods were left. And when St. Nicholas had smoked his pipe, he twisted it in his hatband and laying his finger beside his nose, keep that in mind for a moment, gave the astonished Van Cortlandt a very significant look. Then mounting his wagons, he returned over the treetops and disappeared. So this is where this whole notion of flying through the air, Santa Claus flying through the air, comes from. And it's pretty amazing that this whole mythology of flying came from a fictional character in a fictional book. But it happened. And today, it's evolved to the point where most kids, they just accept this as the gospel truth. And that's an illustration of the power of the mass media and the influence. Now, Irving was a really popular writer. And he wrote several other stories about, Christmas and ancient traditions. And it sparked the curiosity and the imagination of many, many people. His writing had a huge impact on the people of the time. And you can see that influence in other authors. One such author was Clement Moore. Go ahead and do the next slide. In 1823, Clement Moore published a poem called A Visit from St. Nicholas. You might know that poem as called it The Night Before Christmas. I think we had to memorize this in school, if I'm not mistaken, because I still got it memorized, all right? You know how it is. 'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. That one, that poem was hugely popular. And when we look at it, we can see aspects of how Moore borrowed from Washington Irving to further construct this mythos about Christmas. Go ahead and slip, do that next slide there. For example, there's a line that says in the poem, it says, the stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. That's clearly taken from that dream sequence that we just saw. Another line was in that poem is, laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod up the chimney he rose. That's practically a ripoff. That's like plagiarism of Washington Irving there. It came directly from the writings of Washington Irving. But this poem, written by Moore, also helped to separate Christmas from religion. The poem itself mentions nothing about Jesus, nothing about his birth. Instead, Moore literally created the image of Santa Claus that we still have in our heads today. And that included his physical appearance, the night of his visit, his mode of transportation, now it's a flying sled being pulled by reindeer, the number and the names of the reindeer, and the tradition that he's going to bring toys to children. And he kind of pulled together what he did. He pulled all these elements of these various myths and what other people had written and kind of pulled them together in this cohesive picture of Santa Claus. He basically took all the December gods and kind of rolled them into this coherent picture here. So what most of what we would call the myths and legends of our American Santa Claus are really less than 200 years old. I mean, they really are. I mean, you got elements that are older, but this whole cohesive picture that we think is Christmas, that's less than 200 years old. Other elements like the North Pole and Santa's workshop, they're even newer than that. And again, these things are taught as fact to our kids by the media. And you know that if you can get the kids in any kind of movement or tradition, you've got them, because that's gonna stick with them through adulthood. And it's because of that these myths and these legends about Christmas are so deeply ingrained into our culture. Now, certainly the examples that I've already cited in these works of the 1800s, they were instrumental in development and in developing the character and the mythology of Santa Claus. But there's another book that was published in 1843 that perhaps had an even greater influence on how Christmas is perceived and observed today. In this book, it went beyond the myths and the legends about Santa Claus. In fact, the main character in this book is used still today to describe someone who you want to insult, perhaps who might be a cheapskate. Anybody know what Scrooge? Exactly. Go ahead and do that. It is Scrooge. It is Scrooge. Anybody ever been called this name before? Oh, come on. Yeah. When we first started, as I mentioned, we didn't come into the church until we were adults. And the first time that we went to a family gathering, we made it clear at Christmas time, we said, well, we're not going to participate in gift giving. We'll come out to visit, but we don't get our kids any presents. We're not going to give you guys any presents. First thing I got hit with, what are you, a Scrooge? You just don't want to buy presents, do you? I go, no, that's not it at all, you know. But that is what you're labeled a lot of times, especially when you first stop celebrating Christmas. And Scrooge is, of course, the character in a book titled A Christmas Carol. A Christmas Carol. Now, if you're not familiar with the plot, Ebenezer Scrooge is a penny-pinching miser with a heart that is dead and cold, and he does not celebrate Christmas. One Christmas Eve, he's visited by the ghost of his former partner, Jacob Marley. And Jacob Marley tells him, hey, tonight you're going to be visited by three other spirits, three other ghosts, the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas future. Sure enough, he is. And overnight, Scrooge has a change of heart and a change of attitude, and he ends up celebrating Christmas, and they all lived happily ever after. The end. That's basically the plot of A Christmas Carol. When this book was published in England in December of 1843, it was a monster hit. It was a smashing success. We can't equate today. You guys, think of your favorite video game. Think of your favorite book. This was bigger than that. It was bigger than that. There wasn't a lot of competition for written material out there. This was huge. He was a rock star. Charles Dickens was a rock star of the time in the media, right? And it was a good book. There's no disputing that. If you read it just as literature, it had a lot. It had humor. It had emotion. I mean, it was a good book. But it also made such a big impact because it was written and published in the right place at the right time. Now, as mentioned, this book was first published in England. And English popular culture at that time was in the midst of a revival of old customs about Christmas, Christmas customs and traditions. And several books had already been written that were kind of like priming the pump. You know, they were like talking about Christmas past and religions and that, or traditions and all that stuff. In addition, the Queen of England at the time, Queen Victoria, she was married to Prince Albert. Prince Albert was originally from Germany, and Germany was where we get the tradition of Christmas trees. And so, in 1841, just 2 years prior to this book being published, Prince Albert put a Christmas tree in Windsor Castle. So here was this verification from royalty that Christmas traditions and Christmas habits were okay. A-okay. Right? Here's the king and the queen doing it. You know, or the queen at least, with Prince Albert doing it. So it's no doubt that at the time, most of the public was primed and ready to embrace both the resurrected traditions of Christmas as well as the new meaning that was attached. And like the poem, A Night Before Christmas, A Christmas Carol really dealt with Christmas in a non-religious way. The themes that came out of it were generosity, family, and those carried over into our Christmas understanding today. And they were really these themes were created and popularized by this book. At the same time, though, A Christmas Carol made Christmas more popular as a religious holiday, at least for Protestants. Many Protestants at the time, if you go back and read the commentaries, Bible commentaries, written by Protestants in the 1800s, they make no bones about how they felt about Rome. They make no bones about how they felt about the papacy. They had zero respect. They had nothing but contempt. They actually believed that the papacy and the Roman Church were the beast power, or at least the precursor to the beast power, where the false prophet was going to come from. They made no bones about that. They were very clear about it. And Christmas was a Roman Catholic holiday. It was. And so many Protestants had a problem with observing it as a religious holiday. It was too Catholic. And they felt more comfortable when it was presented with these themes. These themes of, well, it's really about generosity and family and giving and the Christmas spirit. In essence, a new Christmas was being developed. And again, this is one that blended these various ancient traditions from various cultures with Jesus Christ and with the themes of giving. We'll get back to A Christmas Carol in just a moment because there's a lot more to be said about that. But by the end of the 1800s, the creation of this Christmas was practically done. I mean, it was practically over with. They had practically developed it all from scratch. And in 1897, there was a famous newspaper article that cemented it. It just like put the icing on the cake of this new Christmas. And it put it firmly into the minds of the public. At that time, in 1897, an 8-year-old girl wrote this letter to a newspaper, the New York Sun. She wrote, "Dear editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says, if you see it in the sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth is there a Santa Claus, signed Virginia O'Hanlon? First thing that strikes me when I read this is Dad didn't want to deal with this, did he? It's like he didn't want to tell her a lie, but he didn't want to tell her the truth either, right? He didn't want to, like, say, well, he wanted his hands off. So he says, well, write to the newspaper, you know. If they say it's true, then it's true. And this reply from a staff writer to this letter became famous. And it went, this is a part of it, it went like this. It said, go ahead and next. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as surely as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would it be if there were in the world if there were no Santa Claus? It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. So here it is. Here is this stuff all blended together. And a newspaper, a major newspaper, just professed to everyone. Remember, written word is the mass media. They just professed to everyone that, yeah, there is a Santa Claus. It's like, A-okay, teach this, make this part of your traditions. We think it's okay to do that. But it took all these elements, and they blended it into a cohesive picture of Santa Claus. And it was the power and the influence of the mass media that did this. Now, when we think back to the 1800s, right, especially toward the beginning, or maybe actually toward the end, right, when this whole thing was either being developed or looked like it was actually going to become part of our culture, there must have been people that saw this happening, and they looked around and said, what is going on in our culture? Have you all lost your mind? Do you see what you're doing? I kind of think about it a little bit like today. We can see major changes in our culture, in our society happening almost right before our very eyes right now. I mean, things that nobody would have thought possible 30 years ago are now standard. I mean, in our culture. And we get frustrated about it, right? I mean, we look at the changes going on and we say, what is going on? Are you people daft? I mean, that must have been the reaction of certainly a few people who saw this new Christmas myth emerging. Many would have said, hey, don't you guys know that this is a fraud? This is a hoax? You're falling for this, right? I want to return to a Christmas carol now, because there's a word that's used very frequently in a Christmas carol that means exactly that. It means a hoax, a fraud, a deception, nonsense, or rubble. Go ahead and do the next slide. And we'll see if we can figure out what that word is by reading a little bit and filling in the blank of a Christmas carol. So let's read a little bit and see if we can figure out what that word is that means a hoax. A Merry Christmas, Uncle! God save you! Cried a cheerful voice. It was the voice of Scrooge's nephew, who came upon him so quickly that this was the first intimidation he had of his approach. Bah! Said Scrooge. Wow, you did that good. Man, that was perfect. He had so heated himself with rapid walking in the fog and frost, this nephew of Scrooge's, that he was all in a glow. His face was ruddy and handsome, his eyes sparkled, and his breath smoked again. Christmas, eh? Uncle, said Scrooge's nephew. You don't mean that, I am sure. I do, said Scrooge. So, that word humbug, go ahead and do the next slide. That means exactly what we talked about. It means something intended to deceive, a hoax or fraud, a person who claims to be other than what he or she is, an imposter, nonsense, rubbish. That's what that word humbug means. You might remember it if you're a reader of L. Frank Baum and the Wizard of Oz books, especially the one where the wizard is introduced. the wizard was called a humbug, because here he is, this guy who presented this big image of this scary-looking guy using technology, using fraud and deception, when really he's just this little guy pulling the strings, basically, right? Now, I can't say exactly what Charles Dickens had in mind when he wrote this book, especially about what Scrooge's inner attitude was about Christmas. But I don't think it's a stretch to think that that this happened in their society quite a bit, that people objected to what was going on around them, and they called it what it was. You know, don't you see this is quite the humbug going on here with Christmas, right? And it must have been pretty unsettling to quite a few. And I wonder if this book was written, and maybe why it was so popular, is that it did address this issue of people who wanted to embrace Christmas and people who saw it as a fraud, as a hoax. As I said, it would kind of remind us of the debate we have today about certain issues. You know, I mean, some people see absolutely nothing wrong with certain practices, and others see a lot wrong with that very same practices. There was a culture war back then, just as there's a culture war today. We know who won that culture war back then about Christmas. We know, because that new Christmas has been continued to grow until it's now celebrated in virtually everywhere in the United States and almost all over the world. It's a religious holiday for Catholics. It's a religious holiday for Protestants. And it's a non-religious holiday for just about everyone else. In essence, we could say that the whole world celebrates Christmas. The whole world celebrates Christmas. And a large part of the growth of Christmas among these religious and these non-religious peoples can be chalked up to a Christmas carol. Because what happened is that it, again, blended the myths and tradition of Christmas with a spiritual yet non-religious component. And you have to look at the three spirits of Christmas, for example. I mean, it took that and those spiritual aspects of giving. Go ahead and do the next slide. Because of this, we know that that modern society, and if you ever heard anybody describe Christmas, what do they say? Well, it's the Christmas spirit. You know, I got into the spirit. Oh, you don't have the Christmas spirit. I mean, that's the word that's used a lot of times to describe this. And in this book, it was appealing because these are the characteristics that Scrooge had, right? He was nasty. He was sarcastic. He was cold-hearted. He was selfish. He was greedy. Scrooge didn't care about anyone but himself and his money. That's all he really cared about. But literally, again, overnight, Scrooge is transformed. He becomes generous. He becomes loving. He becomes kind overnight. And that, I think, is the big appeal of this book and of Christmas. That overnight, we can become good. Overnight. We can be as nasty and as cruel as we want all year long, but at Christmas, there's that chance that just like Scrooge, we're going to get the Christmas spirit, and then we're going to become something that we're not. We're going to become generous. We're going to become loving. We're going to become kind. And that's not a bad thing. I'm not putting that down. You know that. I'm not putting down those aspects. That's what we should want as Christians. That's how we want. That's the path we want to go down. That's what we want to develop. We want to develop those characteristics. But what we're really talking about here that's appealing is this desire to change. Let's turn to Ezekiel chapter 36. It just looked first scripture, and I'm already way into this. Ezekiel 36, we're going to look at scriptures that speak to this desire to change. Ezekiel 36. And we're just going to read one verse, verse 26 of Ezekiel 36. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. Sounds a lot like Scrooge's transformation, doesn't it? And I know you're sitting there saying, well, there's a lot to it, a lot more to it than that. And there certainly is. We know how much more there is. But when someone reads just this verse out of context with no other understanding or meaning, what are they going to think, considering how they've been influenced by modern ideas, especially about Scrooge, right? They're going to think, well, that's just like Scrooge. He had a heart of flesh, or a heart of stone, and overnight he had a heart of flesh. And what this really only proves is that Scrooge's change was a reflection of a spiritual truth, which again kind of makes it appealing. Turn to Galatians 5. We'll read another before and after example. Galatians 5. Now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in time past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. So, again, we can see that many of the works of the flesh were evident in Scrooge, and then later on in the book, fruit of the Spirit is evident. Overnight. So part of the appeal of A Christmas Carol is what? That redemption is possible. That we can change our nature. That we can go from selfish and greedy to loving and generous. And then, because of this belief in Christmas, by extension, we think, well, it could happen at Christmas when we get the Christmas spirit. That this Christmas spirit can instantly change the hearts and minds of men and women at Christmas time. And this idea, it's like an unspoken belief. It's like a popular myth in our culture. But A Christmas Carol is a fictional book. And we live in the real world, not in a fictional book. And remember, this whole notion didn't even exist until 200 years ago or so. The real journey from old Scrooge to new Scrooge takes time. And we know that. It takes diligence. It takes perseverance. It takes patience. It goes and starts and stops. And sometimes we fall back 3 steps and go forward 4. It's a slow process. You can't game the system. There is no magic fairy going to come down and make you good overnight. It's not reality. Real conversion, a real change of our hearts and minds, that takes God. It takes God to do that. Because it's not a quick fix. The real process is not a quick fix. There's not a shortcut to be had because it's a process of growth. Go and turn to Ephesians chapter 4. We'll look at this growth process. Ephesians chapter 4. It's growth. Verse 11 of Ephesians 4, and he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. So, that's the process. It's saying it takes time till we come to this unity of the faith and this knowledge, and it takes time to build ourselves up, as it says in verse 12, edifying, building up the body, to build up ourselves, but also to build up each other individually as churches or as a church. verse 14, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men in the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting. Does that sound familiar about this time of year at all? Sounds relatively familiar. But speaking the truth in love may grow up in all things into him who is the head, Christ. We know the trickery of men. We know what this is, right? It's, when it comes to Christmas, it is a humbug. It is a deceitful plotting. We're not fooled because we know our God and we know the mind of our God and we know our scripture. Christmas is so far away from the reality of God that it kind of looks like a horribly drawn cartoon. It's badly drawn. Diane and I, we live in an area where there's some houses, many houses that put up Christmas lights, and I used to do the same thing. And we were driving by a couple weeks ago and looking at the lights as we're going down the road and thought, wow, those are pretty. Those are pretty. And the next day, we're walking by there during the daytime hours and you see what it really looks like. Bunch of wires hanging down, bunch of cheap plastic or cardboard figures, you know, that are just out there. Kind of ugly. And what that shows, it's a great lesson there. It shows that people would rather have that embrace that sparkly appearance, that beautiful appearance, rather than reality. They'd rather have, knowing that in truth, it's a lot less beautiful, they'd rather have that beauty at the expense of what it really looks like in reality. That reality can't hold up, or that illusion can't hold up to daytime, to the daylight. It brings it to, shows it's a lie. What can we do about Christmas? What can we do about all these things that are happening at this time of the year? Should we go walking around like Scrooge saying, you know, that's humbug! That's humbug, that all Christmas stuff! You guys all doing that stuff. That's humbug. Is that going to win us any friends? Probably not. But that's the answer. We can't do much. I mean, we can't do much. We lost the war. Right? The war is over. The war about Christmas is done and gone. I mean, that boat sailed. We still need to put out messages like this. That's still our responsibilities as Christians to when someone figures out that they've had the wool pulled over their eyes, they need to go someplace to have that explained to them, or they need to tune in so that we can tell them that, hey, this is what happens. God uses us still. I'm not saying that, but we certainly don't have to be nasty about it. I mean, that's just silly. In fact, if we're growing spiritually in God's grace, God's knowledge, it's going to be impossible for us to walk around like that, calling everything humbug, you know, to be mean about it. Turn back to Galatians 5. It should have just stayed there, but go ahead and go back to Galatians 5. Go ahead and verse 22, we'll look at the fruit of the Spirit again. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. So, ideally, we shouldn't be perturbed by this the more we grow. However, I have a confession to make about this. Have you ever drive down the road and you see those big blow-up things, the blow-up Christmas things, you know, big old Santa Claus or... Did you ever get the urge to bring like a BB gun with you sometime and drive down the road? Don't listen to me. Don't do that. But that's a reflection of a carnal mind trying to make us be that way. I'm not suggesting I had that thought, although I did, but but we can't let that overtake us. We gotta recognize that for what it is and clamp it down and hopefully tell it in a funny story after we realize how stupid we are. So you gotta like make sure you just get that stuff down. Because what happens when we're nasty like this is it it destroys our credibility. It destroys our credibility. It's like Scrooge. He had no credibility because he wasn't credible. Here's this guy that's trying to tell people that Christmas is a humbug, and he's like the worst representative of the opposite point that anyone could see. It's like, what does this guy know about love and generosity? What? Why would I listen to you? And that credibility is important to us. I mean, as people of God. Turn to Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2. We'll look a couple examples of this credibility. Titus chapter 2. Go ahead and start in verse 7 of Titus 2. In all things, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works, in doctrine showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you. If the first thing that someone knows about me that I don't know is that I go around shooting down inflatable Santa Clauses with a BB gun, there's no pattern there that they can perceive, right? I mean, there's no pattern of good works. It's just the opposite. Skip forward to chapter 3, verse 1. Should just be one up there. Remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. If we don't have that good reputation that it's talking about here, if we don't have that with our friends, if we don't have that with our family, if we don't have that with our coworkers, if we don't have that with our acquaintances, then anything we try to tell them about God and Jesus Christ and His truth, it's going to fall on deaf ears. They're not going to listen to us. They're just going to, oh, here he comes, turn it off. They're not going to listen to us at all. But if our character, if how they know us is as loving and joyful and peaceful and long-suffering and kind and good and faithful and gentle, then they're going to think twice when they find out that we don't keep Christmas. Their first instinct isn't going to be to call us a stooge. And instead of a stooge, a Scrooge, they might call us a stooge, but that's a different story, right? So instead of a barrier, we're going to be planting seeds. They're not automatically rejecting it. Instead of a wall of silence, we're going to invite discussion. Well, why does he feel that way? And instead of rejection, we're going to arouse that curiosity. It's that spirit of love and gentleness. And that's really how Jesus did it when he walked the earth. He didn't, for the most part, didn't walk around, although there were occasions when he had to get in the faces of people that were outright opposing him. But to most people, he didn't walk around and be nasty about it. He told them the truth in a kind, loving, gentle way. So because we're supposed to be that way, because that's our goal to be that way, because we should be that way, we should be able to go through the Christmas season just like we go through any other time of year. We should be joyful because we are joyful all year long. We don't need this mythical spirit of Christmas to dwell in us. We have the spirit of the living God living in and living through us. We don't need our redemption and our spirituality to spring from our holiday that was invented by men. We got the real deal. We got the real deal in the Spirit of Christ and in this book. For our last set of scriptures, let's turn to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. Verse 4 of Philippians 4. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Everyone that we know and meet should see us and know that we are different, that we have some type of credibility. Verse 6, be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your request be known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds through Christ Jesus. We don't have to be upset that we drive around and see Christmas lights. We don't have to be upset that we go in the store and we see all this Christmas shoved into our face. We say to God, God, help me get rid of this bitterness and anxiousness and resentment that I'm feeling right now. Please get it out of there. Tamp it down. Remove it. Whatever you want to do with it, God, so I can continue to live joyfully. Nothing should be different for us. Instead of getting worked up about lies and myths, we should remember the wise words in verse 8. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue, and if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on those things. Brethren, in this Christmas season, let's meditate on what's true and rejoice in it.